It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacey Higginbotham is here. Jeff Jarvis. So is Kevin Marks visiting us. We're going to talk about the latest craze with all the cool kids, Mastodon. Kevin will explain what it means and why it's not a Twitter killer. Why is Jeff Bezos cashing in all of that Amazon stock? I'll give you a hint. It involves no bathrooms. Is that a hint? And why is Google buying $1 billion worth of LG OLED displays? It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 400, recorded Wednesday, April 12th, 2017. Toot, not tweet. This Week in Google is brought to you by Segment, the leading unified customer data platform. Segment collects data across your websites, mobile apps, and cloud platforms, and delivers it to over 170 third-party tools and apps. Get 3 months free on the Segment team plan when you sign up at segment.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show. Wow, we got a good show today for you. We talk about Google, the Googleverse, Facebook, Twitter, what's going on in the world around us. And the birthday girl is here, Stacey Higginbotham, working with us on her 30th birthday. And I'm really honored, Stacey, that you would be here.
Okay, I'll fess up. It's actually my 39th birthday.
No, really?
Oh, yeah, really.
You really actually look much younger. I would not have guessed that.
You do.
You look fabulous, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
And I told Karsten, you know, give her the day off, but thank you for being here. I know you're going to a nice dinner with your family. You've already had cake.
A lot of cake. And I am hoping to get you guys to sing happy birthday to me because I think it'll be awesome.
Will definitely happen. And now that we can without paying license fees.
Right. That is.
We don't have to sing that fake happy birthday song they do at the restaurants. Also with us, Jeff Jarvis. He's in town. Nice. Great to see you, JJ. We missed you.
I missed you too.
We missed you. Did you have a nice trip to, where were you? Germany?
Perugia.
Oh, yeah. You went to Italy?
The International Journalism Festival.
Oh, Stacey and I were so jealous. Matthew Ingram was there too.
I'm back.
Beautiful little town, Perugia.
It is. You've been there?
No, but that's where they send, my sister went there. That's where they send the exchange students to get educated into the ways of the Italian culture before they let them loose in the country. they have a very good language school there. And great to have Kevin Marks, who has relocated to a comfy couch.
In the United Kingdom.
Somewhere in the north of England. Wow.
North Yorkshire, yes.
That is nice.
So you don't get to see the outside here, my friend, because it's too late. You have to run the show like 5 hours earlier, so it can be light outside.
Yeah, it's like 10 p.m. now, right? It's 10 or 11? Yeah.
Well, 10 p.m., yeah.
I apologize. okay. We had no idea.
I thought you were just, boy, this is a trip going on forever.
I'm going to take the hat. Yeah. I left a hat on Jeff. That's really not. I'll wear it. This is my Westworld Man in Black hat.
Oh, that is nice.
Yeah. That's because it's raining here in Northern California.
So how far are you from what will soon be the border wall to Scotland?
It's about 150 miles to Scotland.
Yeah.
But you know, there's already a wall there that was put up by Hadrian.
You know? Damn Romans. I tell you, if you'd only kept it up.
That was the perfect Kevin slap.
Oh, you mean Hadrian's wall? Yeah. So much to talk about. Where should we start?
We have one priority before anything else.
Yes. What?
We have to sing happy birthday, don't we?
Well, should we do that now?
Well, I think Stacey should show her videos. I think Google won unquestionably over Amazon.
What videos are we talking about?
You would have to go to Twitter to see them, and I'm not sure if you're prepared for this, Leo.
I don't use Twitter. You know that. I'm a Mastodon man, all in.
You're all in on Mastodon. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to post this to Mastodon, but I did a comparison of the Amazon Echo singing Happy Birthday to Me and Google Home. And they're somewhat different.
Let's try it. Let's see. Here you go. Let me turn on the audio, though.
Happy birthday. If you'd like, I can sing to you. Just ask me to sing Happy Birthday, and we can celebrate this special day with song.
Sing Happy Birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy
She has quite a nice voice.
Oh, just wait till Google goes.
Yeah, is he a cheater? Would have been really impressive.
Are those olives in the foreground?
Happy birthday, Stacy.
No, those are pretty acorns that my daughter collected.
Oh, that's neat.
A lovely crystal bowl.
You know, well, here in Petaluma, the Indians, the locals used to, they lived on acorns. They would grind them up, and we have lots of acorn.
It's my birthday.
Pestles, mortars and pestles. You can dig them up, and that's what they lived on. So grind it up. It's delicious.
Oh. It's my birthday.
Well, happy birthday. I hope you have an amazing
Google
day.
Home.
Sing happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday
Twitter.
To you. Happy birthday to the most amazing person in the universe. Happy birthday to you.
Yeah, and she did a little auto-tuning kind of stuff, and wow.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed the most amazing person in the universe, because I never hear that.
Yeah, that's pretty
nice. Is that what you told it to call you?
No, I was hoping it would say, because I've taught it how to say my name, but it doesn't care, so it doesn't actually use that.
I'm sure it cares deeply.
But Tom's, I don't know if it's Simonite over at MIT Tech Review. He's an editor over there. He told Google Assistant it was his birthday, and he got a Anchorman poster that said, "Happy birthday, Tom, you beautiful bastard," or something like that. So
it mailed it to him.
IMs it to him. Allos it to him.
Oh, okay.
Whatever.
Nice.
I did it. And let's see if it'll show you what it gave me. That's also on Twitter, but it gave me Happy Birthday, Stacy. And it has this super purple pink flower cake thing.
Oh, because it knows you're a woman.
Well, that's the thing. I think it just found a Stacy Happy Birthday. But Google normally thinks I'm a man because of the types of sites I go to.
And Stacy could be either, right? You can't tell.
Or you could be both, and there's nothing wrong with that.
There would be nothing wrong with that. For one, celebrate gender dysphoria. Where is it? I shouldn't have said that, should I?
No, you shouldn't have.
I shouldn't have said that. I don't see this reputed tweets because I've been searching Twitter. So I don't see this picture.
Okay.
But I do see an article you wrote for the Technology Review that I think is quite interesting. So one of the big stories this week is that Plume is raising money, a lot of money. This is one of the mesh Wi-Fi players, $27 million at least.
I think it might have been 37, wasn't it?
It was going up. And interestingly, that the lead investor turns out to be, guess, Comcast.
Comcast.
Now, I happen to like the Plume. In fact, that's what we use at home now. And it made sense for me because at $79 each, it can add up quite quickly to a very expensive Wi-Fi. But it works, so it's like, okay. It's $49 each. It seems like I paid more than that. Anyway.
The three-pack originally was more, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the thing they're doing that's interesting, so there's like the traditional mesh Wi-Fi action that's happening and everybody's doing. TP-Link just actually introduced some today.
Yeah, everybody. Link says TP-Link. Of course, there's Eero, which kicked the things off. Happened to Luma? Luma never did ever come out?
It did come out. It exists.
Linksys has Velop.
Velop.
The Orbi, which isn't technically mesh. The Amplify, which from Ubiquiti, the company that really invented this way back when for enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
But I, after trying a bunch of them, and I don't know if the Wirecutters yet made their pick, but I decided
they picked the Orbi.
Okay, as the fastest. And that was my experience as well. It was really fast.
But it's not a mesh.
But it's not a mesh. So the, they call it the best Wi-Fi mesh networking kit for most people. The Netgear Orbi, which is interesting. It, I got great results from the Orbi, but I liked the idea of the plume being in every room.
And they manage everything in the cloud. So what's happening there is it's they're really going to be trying to give you Wi-Fi as a service and have it truly adapt to your home in ways that the Eero might do with over-the-air software updates every now and then. But they're going to be doing it. Plume is going to be trying to do it on the fly. So it's a slightly different kind of model.
They're and also cuter, and you plug them into the wall, so you have less choice.
Isn't
about
that what the Google one did, and that's why it fell over when some site with Google went down?
It fell over?
Do you remember that?
You talking about the On Hub or the Google Mesh Wi-Fi?
Yeah, the Google On Hub, where it it managed to brick itself, and you had to restart it and relog in because it got a configuration from the net.
Oh, that's
that was
weird.
Like 2 months ago, do you remember?
Oh, yeah, I do remember. I know now. When you said fell over, I pictured it falling off a desk.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I'm like, I got you now. I do remember. I don't remember the cause, so, but I bet you're right.
Yeah. So, Jim Salter, who we actually had on the new Screensavers to talk about the various ones, was test. He's a network engineer, so he really tested these. And he has the same conclusion I do, which is, there isn't one perfect one. It really depends a lot on your house. For instance, he says, for a bigger house, the Eero is better because its satellites could talk to one another instead of having to talk to the base, and you can add units. But it didn't have the raw signal strength of the Orbi, which I experienced, or the Amplify HD. On the other hand, he thought the Amplify HD was the slowest of the bunch. So it's really kind of confusing space. But you have an interesting theory about why Comcast is putting so much money into Plume.
Well, when I talked to Plume's CEO, I met him here in Austin before they launched, so a while back. Very smart man. What he talked about is he wanted to be able to eventually charge people for SLAs on their Wi-Fi, essentially. Oh. And the hope was that ISPs would pay Plume for this to manage all the Wi-Fi networks for them, or they would pass that on to their subscribers.
SLA stands for service level agreement. You're saying a guaranteed level of service, quality of service.
Right. Because they can do all that in the cloud, they can actually, and it's software defined, so they can partition out enough bandwidth for your television, for example. And that's really a compelling offering for service providers because when you pay for broadband and cable from Comcast, you certainly want it to work on your television. But it also, as they're bringing in all these devices in the home, they want to be able to, if they sell you a doorbell, they want to guarantee Wi-Fi getting all the way out to your doorbell.
Right.
And this is a good way to do it.
It's one of the reasons I ended up using mesh, because I wanted my Ring to be accessible out at the doorbell. But I like the idea of small pools of Wi-Fi per room pools. Because if I look at my, when I use Insider or some other tool to look at my Wi-Fi, the 2.4 gigahertz band, I'm seeing somebody's printer. We don't live next door to anybody. They're at least several hundred feet away. I see printers, routers. I see all sorts of stuff. Because everything, all the Wi-Fi gear now has been turned up. It all has more power. So, but the 5 gigahertz bandwidth, which doesn't travel as well, doesn't go through walls as well, is clear, is clean. So I like the idea of a 5 gigahertz router that automatically picks that channel if it needs to. All of the mesh routers do a good job of that, much better. They're all at least dual band. Some are tri-band. Go ahead, Kevin.
So the 2.4 gigahertz has trouble with microwaves and water and things,
right,
whereas the 5 gigahertz is cleaner for that. So the travel further thing depends on what else is around.
Well, the higher frequency, though, is more hindered by things in the way, right? I mean,
yeah.
So,
But it depends what they make, because basically the 2.4 gigahertz is a resonance frequency of water molecules. So if you're trying to put it through rain or anything that has a high amount of water in it, then you've got problems.
Interesting.
There's an issue in San Francisco. One of the, I can't remember which one it is, but one of the networking companies there uses Wi-Fi network bridges. And when it's foggy, the bandwidth goes down.
Wow. Well, but see, that's why I like the Plume model. As long as they can talk to one another and then create these little pools of Wi-Fi, You're almost always next to the router because there's one in every room. So you're never more than 10 feet from a router, which works quite well, I think.
Smart.
So their plan, and I'm sure Comcast's plan, is to be part of the deal. Like when you get a Comcast cable modem, you'd get the Plume routers. That would be good.
That would be good. And they actually, Comcast at, I think it was at CES this year, they introduced a new cloud-based Wi-Fi program that they got when they bought a company. I think it was called PowerDog a few years back. And PowerDog was actually a really early company doing better Wi-Fi before Eero, before all these other guys.
Right.
So Comcast is thinking hard. I mean, you know, we can talk about its regulatory positions, but from a technology perspective, they have really good engineering staff. Well, and they look ahead.
They need to because their business, which was, the old ditch digging business of bringing television into people's homes, is faltering in the internet era, right?
Well, they charge you for the routers every month.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just the whole idea of, oh, I get my Showtime from Comcast, that's going away now because of over the top. I'm looking at, you know, I've been playing with YouTube TV. We talked about it last week, but I just love YouTube TV, and I could see this being for a lot of people. It's got a built-in DVR. It doesn't have a huge selection of stations, as we mentioned, but it's getting more. This is a really this is an example of where over the top is going. How long before Comcast just gets kicked out of the house? Except you
well,
still
they're,
need an
they're
ISP.
Talking about doing their own. I think we have a story on here.
They are talking about it, but their, they yeah. You know, this is one of those I don't, you know why I didn't really highlight this story, because they said sometime, maybe next year. Well, I mean, it's like
they own NBCU, so they,
well, they
I mean,
I know.
Their biggest challenge is going to be making sure the FCC doesn't, you know, castigate them for it. But this FCC is probably going to be like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. No, the fact they've already telegraphed
the
that, right? Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, zero rate all you want. So Comcast is going to do an OTT service, over-the-top service, which is kind of weird, in competition with itself.
It's not, though, because, like, it's a different... My parents are probably never going to get rid of cable television.
Right.
But my daughter is never going to subscribe to cable television.
Right. That's why I thought YouTube TV was such a good play, because that gets the YouTube generation, right?
Yes.
Comcast does have this stream already. I have the Comcast stream in my cable box. But you can't tell us... I mean, how do you know it's internet? I mean, it's not... It's just in the cable box. Most people, I would think, wouldn't like to get rid of Comcast. If they had a better choice for internet service provider, they would. So that's my point, is that Comcast is smart to make itself a better internet service provider. That's clearly what's on the table. At least that's my thought. Okay, we're boring everybody. Interesting story from Forbes. Google apparently, actually this originally came from South Korea's Electronic Times, is trying to make a massive $880 million mega deal with LG to secure a large supply of what everybody wants these days, flexible OLED displays. We know Samsung has a deal with Apple for 93 million displays for new iPhones. Samsung kind of has the lock on OLED displays and has for a long time. But what's interesting is these flexible OLED displays are used in mostly bezel-less phones. This is the future of phones. The Samsung Galaxy S8, which comes out in a week from Friday, the rumored iPhone for late this year, all bezel-less screens. And so when you look at the current Pixel, it's going to look pretty darn antiquated next to these new phones. So Google's probably smart to say, how do we get rid of this frame around the screen? The deal is not done, though. But this is something you might expect in a next generation Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL.
Oh, see, I'm glad I waited to update. I'll wait for the fancy, non-antiquated phone look.
Yes. Actually, I really prefer it. Not having a bezel is great. The LG G6 is like this, too. It really is great.
I'm just not sure about the rounded edge and how to hold it.
Well, when the S8... I'll have the S8 next week, but they aren't as aggressive, I think, as the S7 was. We really did go all the way around. The S8 does give you more of an edge because they realize you need to hold it, right? People need to hold it.
Quite.
But it's nice because getting rid of the bezel means you can have a phone that doesn't get out of control, but a bigger screen. That's, I think, to be desired, right?
And so what are the case? The cases just then cover the bezel, right? Or cover the a little bit of the
edge? Well, this is the S8. So if you look at the S8, the edge, they call it the infinity display. It practically goes off the edge. You can hardly see a frame on the left and right. And then they were able to, you know, Samsung finally got rid of its physical home key. So now they have just very small. I mean, they have to have some bezel, but they're very small, you know, for cameras and speakers and microphones.
They put a camera and something in there,
Yeah. But they've got them pretty darn small. I can't wait to get mine. And by doing that, they are able to get a 6.2-inch screen in a phone the size of Apple's iPhone 7 Plus, which has a 5.5-inch screen. So a lot more screen without increasing the phone size.
So have you guys seen, have you talked about the Centio?
No,
what's Superbook?
That? Superbook.
Go to Centio, Centio.com.
Transform your smartphone into a laptop. Oh, well, this, so this is very similar to what, this is what Samsung's doing with what they call DeX for the SE. Right. I've ordered one of those. I'll get that as well. I can show you that in a couple of weeks. And then, of course, Microsoft does it with something they call Continuum. But remember, it was done first on Android with the Atrix. Remember the Motorola Atrix?
Yeah.
It was a phone that turned into a laptop. So the idea, this is a shell. I don't think this is going to do as well as, so the DeX and the Continuum are just docks. The DeX is funny because you put your phone in it, it charges, it has a fan in it because your S8 is going to get really hot when you use it on the desktop. And then I think what I'm really intrigued in, Samsung has modified Android so that once it says, oh, you're on a 27-inch screen, it makes it look more like a desktop operating system with a menu bar and
that's more for overlapping windows. Desktop. This is a laptop to travel with and get a larger screen. The reason I brought this up now is because the effort to get ever more pixels and more space in your screen, but not make it too big to hold, at some point,
but you want to carry
just that device you use here and there, and then you carry something else.
Why not carry a laptop?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
I guess, and by the way, this is a Kickstarter, so don't get...
that was my thing when I upgraded all my gear just before I moved here. So I got the 15-inch MacBook. I got last year's 15-inch MacBook because I actually like having ports and a power cable
too.
won't destroy the device with. But since that means I do have lots of pixels, and it is usable in that way. Whereas all the other ones that are that bit smaller didn't quite cut it.
I guess the idea is if you're carrying around a modern smartphone, you're carrying around desktop quality processors,
and
all your data's on here, all your connectivity's on here. So why bother?
Carrying
a second device, why I like the dock, because you can bring the dock with you and you get to somewhere else, and all you need is a keyboard, mouse, and a monitor. I don't know if hotels are going to.
You're sitting on a plane though,
right?
With this, right. You can store the movie on
that's
your phone.
Interesting. How much is it?
And watch on this, $119.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
And it looks actually kind of like a Chromebook, or
yeah. And it doesn't tether because your connectivity is your phone.
Right. That's the beauty of it. $3 million they raised for the Superbook. Turn your smartphone into a laptop. Huh. Well, it does kind of make sense. Oh, now they've got backlit keys, extra USB port. Oh, this is funny. They've got a lot of stretch goals. 1080p.
Yeah, for $55 more, you get the 1080p and the backlit keys.
I would get that for sure, right? Are you getting it?
I don't know. Something I'll end up complaining about.
Right. One thing that, besides modifying Android so it fits better on a screen, it looks better on a desktop, they also got Microsoft to provide applications, and Samsung's going to do some applications that do windowing, that do overlapping, that do tiling, that make it, because that's one, you know. Anyway, let's take a break. Come back with more. Google Home app is hitting at multi-user support, finally, something that the Alexa's had for a while. I'm sorry, the Echo's had for a while. The Google Book search.
Burger King ads.
Facebook, F8's coming up, what we might be seeing. Oh, and Jeff, we got to talk about your new initiative.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
We'll Craig Newmark. That. It's been so long since we talked to you. Craig Newmark, yeah. Facebook and Mozilla to bring integrity back to the news biz.
And Jeff, which we ruin here every week.
Jeff, you're involved. Yeah. Well, we do that.
Yeah.
I do that.
We don't get $14 million either.
I'm just kidding.
Our show today brought to you by Segment. Now, this is a little bit data geeky, so bear with me if you're not one of those people who's responsible for a website or an app or an engineer responsible for collecting analytics. Segment's a data hub, a platform, really, that makes it easy to collect and unify and act on customer data no matter where it comes from, your website, your mobile app, your cloud platforms, and then process it. It's kind of like plumbing. So the way we do it, or we did it, and I think the way a lot of people are, you got a website, you start putting stuff, little JavaScript stubs in there for Google Analytics and heat mapping and chart beat. And you pretty soon you got 50 different little stubs in there because you want to know what's going on with your website. Well, imagine if instead of that, you put one line of code, your segment code, and then everything is piped into your segment dashboard where you can graphically say where things go. This is the easiest way to do it. And man, you're going to save a lot of engineering time. Plus, your website will be more reliable. It'll be easier to use. It's a single API. You write code integration just once, and it unifies all your data and performing analytics on any platform, from Marketo to MailChimp. Atlassian uses it. Intuit uses it. New Relic and Reuters, some of the world's best companies. You could choose from hundreds of partner integrations, including the most popular apps for advertising, analytics, A-B testing, attribution. That's just the A's. With Segment, one engineer, one guy or gal can quickly integrate a new analytics tool for the data-driven account manager, another for the app-happy marketer, another for the data scientist who needs a unified data warehouse. And what's nice is if anything, any of the services you're using is offline for a little bit, don't worry. Segment will continue to gather the data and then upload it to the service when it comes back online. You can bring in your data from any source, import historical data, customize what ends up in your data warehouse of choice. It's the customer data platform both developers and analysts love. It's got a great API, an extensive partner ecosystem, and it's going to save you a lot of time and a lot of money integrating these tools. And by the way, your CEO will love the quickly deployed integrations with Zendesk and Intercom and Nexus and on and on and on. Over 8,000 of the world's best companies use Segment. I bet you never even heard of it. I hadn't. To drive growth and revenue. It's exactly what you're looking for. Try it free, the team plan, for 3 months when you sign up at segment.com/twit. segment.com/twit. So let's talk about this this new venture, Jeff. It's the Tau folks are among the contributors. There's quite a few. Craig Newmark, Ford Foundation, Democracy Fund, the Knight Foundation, the Tau Foundation, AppNexus, and BetaWorks. A total $14 million fund. And what are you going to do with it? And are the CUNY School of Journalism, Graduate School of Journalism, is going to administer it. That's you.
That's us. That's us. That's me.
So what are you going to do with this money?
So this all started with Craig Newmark, who gave us a challenge and said, do something about misinformation and disinformation. And Craig, as you know, has been quite generous lately in his support of journalism. He's always been generous, but he's really decided to step up and give a lot of money to a lot of players.
Thank
like
you, Craig. That's great.
Mozilla and Pointer and I think First Draft and other places. So Craig's been doing great. So he put the challenge out to us. We came up with something that I'll describe in a second. And then out of nowhere, I got a call from Facebook who said, what you up to? We're thinking about looking for kind of a clearinghouse for doing more things about journalism. I explained what Craig had started, and they said, oh, sounds good. Then along came Ford, and then we ended up with 9 funders and $14 million. We'll work on trust and news. I think that the opportunities we saw were, number one, I think there's been too much discussion about just the platforms and the publishers, and we need to really talk about the public conversation, the journalism is about informing the public conversation. We've got to figure that out. Number two, I think we need to bring more parties into the discussion, other responsible and affected parties like ad agencies and brands and ad networks and ad tech and PR and politics and so on. Number three, We saw the opportunity to convene people and bring people together so they could collaborate. Number four, I see an opportunity for a flight to quality. I think if you add up the fact that we talked about this 2 weeks ago, Havas and Guardian and BBC and Verizon all dumped out of YouTube advertising, telling Google to get their act together. And Sleeping Giants has gotten 1,000-some advertisers to drop Breitbart. And Bill O'Reilly's advertisers are disappearing like horses over the, over the horizon.
So is Bill, apparently.
And so is Bill, too. So, you know, you start to add it all together. And I think that finally advertisers are saying, well, it does matter where my ad appears. It does matter where my money goes. And I think there's an opportunity there. So we're gonna fund much of this. Most of this money will leave CUNY and go out, and we're going to fund research projects and convenings in New York and around the world. There's one project that's already underway that I've written about a little bit, which is about trying to gather signals about sites of quality and disrepute to help platforms, advertisers, ad networks, and ad agencies decide where to put their money and maybe cut off some of the air supply to the bad guys. I want to get some research going on how the conversation operates. So it's really quite an opportunity, quite an obligation. And let me be clear here that none of the Facebook money goes into my pocket. And I emailed Leo as soon as this happened and made sure that there wasn't a worry about conflict of interest with the show. I'll have to be clear about this as it goes. The final thing to say is that we negotiated, my dean, Sarah Bartlett, and I, Sarah's been on the show. We negotiated independence. Without independence, I wouldn't have done this for a second. And so there's a governance structure that guarantees us independence and guarantees me independence. Otherwise, I simply wouldn't have done this. But nonetheless, you know, I debated about this. But when Facebook, you know, when you yell at Facebook for 2 years and Google for 2 years and you say, do something to help journalism, and then they come knocking at your door and say, will you help us help journalism? To my mind, how could I say no? So I'm grateful we got these resources. I hope I don't squander them. I hope we use them really well in focused and targeted ways.
Example of some of the things you're looking at? I mean,
I think I want to understand better how the conversation occurs. I think we've got to do a better job of being transparent about the manipulation that occurs of the platforms and then of us. There's also talk about news literacy. And news literacy can be a condescending term. Like, if you read our news, you're literate. If you don't, you're not. But news literacy, more broadly defined, about recognizing that the public is part of the creation and dissemination of information and news matters. I also care about making media more public literate, about getting journalists to listen better and understand the public better, and I've talked about that in the show. I really care about new forms of news, bringing journalism to the public conversation when it occurs, bringing news to Twitter and to Facebook in the forms that are appropriate for there. You know, look at Snapchat forces us to remake our news for Snapchat, but otherwise Facebook says, okay, here's a spot for your articles. Put your articles in there. I don't think that's sufficient. So those are the kinds of things that we'll get going on.
Sounds very cool. I hope you'll keep us up to date as you start new initiatives and so forth. It's a challenge.
Well, thanks for the plug time there. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge. It's a huge challenge. And there's a lot of other great organizations out there. My favorite is an organization called First Draft Coalition, which was funded at the beginning by Google. Claire Wardle and her sister Jenny Sargent are brilliant at this. They did a huge fact-checking effort in the French election with newsrooms there. They're just amazing. The Trust Project, which Richard Gingras has helped back, is about trying to get metadata around sites. Dan Gilmore at Arizona State does a lot of work in news literacy. So we come to this not competing, trying to help, but I now have some money and resources to try to help. So,
you know, it reminds me that the Pulitzers came out in the last week, and you've got to be somewhat encouraged by the people who won Pulitzers. I mean, ProPublica,
right?
International Consortium of Investigative Journalists from McClatchy.
Two of our former students were part of the Daily News ProPublica project. But the best of all is David Ferrantoli.
If he had not won
a Pulitzer,
yeah,
there would have been riots in newsrooms.
He won for his coverage of Donald Trump's charitable donations. New York Times staff. I guess some could say, oh, it's the usual suspects. You know, Peggy Noonan at the Journal. I think it's really encouraging when you read this. It's clear a lot of good journalism is being done. And I don't mean left-wing journalism, but I mean just good investigative journalism.
You know, and let's be honest, a lot of it is liberal journalism. And I've argued in the past on the show that we need more conservative journalism. We need more journalism from the conservative worldview so that it can gain the trust of that part of America. Being clear, there's plenty of other communities that also are underrepresented. African-Americans, Latino-Americans, LGBT, immigrants, women. Lots of categories of America are underrepresented and thus aren't trusted. They don't trust the media.
Right. Google, remember Google? Remember Google Book Search? In fact, I think when we started this show, that was kind of a hot topic some years ago. Actually, the project started, I didn't realize this. I'm reading Scott Rosenberg's great article on Back Channel about this. I didn't realize it started 15 years ago.
That's amazing.
And this was Google saying, screw it. We're not going to worry about copyright. We're not going to worry about what publishers say. We're just going to start scanning the world's libraries, all the books, because we think that's going to add real value. And then, of course, publishers sued. A lot of famous authors said this is horrible. We talked about, I know, Jeff, you were on a lot of these conversations about the authors.
Siva Vaidyanathan was also on the show talking about it at the time. Mm-hmm.
And Google won its court cases. Took them a long time.
Yep.
They only won a few years ago. But the judge in the case, ultimately, it was a decade-long legal battle that ended last year. The Supreme Court turned down an appeal by the Authors Guild, and the judge whose opinion it was, not the Supreme Court, but the lower court judge whose opinion it was, said the public good is served. There's more benefit to society than there's a downside for authors. And that's clearly the case. But it seems like maybe this 10-year battle sapped Google of its initiative on this. It feels like... Well, here's what Rosenberg writes. When I started work on this story, I feared at first that books is no longer existed as a discrete part of the Google organization. That Google had actually shut the project down. When I started asking questions, it closed up like a startled turtle. For weeks, there didn't seem to be anybody around or available who could or would speak to the current state of the books effort. And then he's saying he looks at the Google Books history page. That trails off in 2007. Blog stopped updating in 2012. So he said, what's going on? There are still, apparently, some Googlers working on book search. They're still adding new books, although at a much slower pace, he says, than the peak, 2010-2011. He interviewed a Google engineer who had worked on books for a decade and now leads the team, Stefan Jaskovic. We're not focused on shiny features and things that are very visible to users, said Jaskovic. It's more like behind-the-scenes work and perfecting the technology, acquiring content, processing it properly, so we can view the entire book online and adjusting the search algorithm. It seems like it's backburned a little bit, which is too bad because I think this is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Jaskovic,
it could be a super powerful source of training type data for teaching computers how to interpret all kinds of things.
I bet you that was one of the goals. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. It's like just entering the world's knowledge into a computer and hoping it gets smart.
Yeah, well, that's how IBM trained Watson. They send it medical-specific data or lawyer-specific data. So imagine literature data and what a computer could tell us based on that. It's kind of fun. Or scary. I don't know. Depends on the literature.
Scott Rosenberg quotes Stefan Jaskovic saying, the scanning stations continue to involve new revisions. These are the book scanning stations. New revisions roll out every 6 months. LED lighting not available at the project's start has helped, so as studying more efficient techniques for human operators to flip pages. It's almost like finger picking on a guitar, he says. So we find people who have great ways of turning pages. Where's the thumb and that kind of stuff? What a horrible job. Feeding the books into the machine.
Well, originally they cut the spines off and fed them through that way. But
yikes.
No, but if you're just buying a perfect bound thing, that works. So there was one of the Google buildings, 45, I think, has all the spines stuck on the wall, like a fake bookshelf.
How funny!
From when they were doing it that way,
when they were cutting them up. Wow!
But it depends on the books. If it's an old book from a classic collection, you have to turn the pages.
Right.
But that was a way of taking a lot of stuff and feeding it through quickly. But there's two other groups that do this as well. Obviously, there's Amazon, who have Book Search, and there's the Internet Archive, who have been scanning books for a long time and continue to do it and have improving their search of scan material quite a lot recently as well.
I wonder how much of, you know, the energy of this, which is sapped by the court fight.
I sense that this has happened in the early days of Google's relationship with journalism, too, where I think that Larry and Sergey cared, and then everybody started smashing them, and they kind of said, well, okay, enough. Yeah. We got other work to do.
Rosenberg writes, you'd think a Supreme Court victory would have meant a renewal of energy for Google Books. Rev up the scanners, full speed ahead, but by all evidence, this has not been the case. Partly that's because the database is already so huge. Jaskovic says we have a fixed budget that we're spending. At the beginning, we were scanning everything on every shelf. At some point, we started getting a lot of duplicates. Today, Google gives its partner libraries pick lists instead. Well, maybe they got everything. But there are plenty of other explanations for the dampening of Google's ardor. The bad taste left from the lawsuits, the rise of shiny and exciting new ventures with more immediate payoffs.
Is Ruth Porat
one? Ruth Porat must be one, right?
Yeah.
What is this light item?
Yeah. I don't know. I always thought this was great, and it was obvious it would not impinge on book sales, but it would make
quite the contrary.
It would help. Yeah,
it would help. You could find them. I've done all the time. I have bought so many books because I found it on search.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you buy it.
Mm-hmm. Although I will confess, when I was in maybe high school, and so this was like in 1995. I remember downloading some book program and getting access to all of these, you know, they were public works. So I think
that's appropriate.
I spent hours as a kid, basically, or as a cheap student, reading all of these books
on
my desktop.
That's awesome, right? That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But if Google Books had been around, I probably would have just gone that way.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think in the Google Book Search you can read the entire text of any book.
I don't think you could either.
You can read pages.
You can for the pre-922 ones, I think, if you search for...
For the orphaned works or the non-copyright works.
But no, they're out of copyright ones, not the orphaned ones.
Copyright, but not... Nobody claims them. And that was the Author Guild's issue, was the orphaned works.
Yeah, which is stupid, because, you know, you want those back in publication.
Right.
The point is, the cost of making digital edition should not be high, especially if Google's already scanned the damn thing. If they're going to scan an OCR it for you, then you can make a digital edition from that.
Yeah, put it on Amazon. Long tail, remember?
Yeah.
It's incremental income. Facebook is facing increased publisher resistance to instant articles. I did not know this, Jeff, but...
There's been some ardor... Is wearing off, yeah.
New York Times has quit.
I think that's a negotiation ploy as much as anything.
Okay. How is AMP doing? I mean, AMP is the kind of the open version of instant articles, right?
Yeah, it's funny. Each has its adherents. I think instant articles is trying to increase, because Facebook can control the monetization there. You can sell the publisher can sell their own ads, but Facebook controls the opportunities. So they're adding a lot of ad opportunities. They're trying to pump up the monetization. AMP is a page that's out there. The problem with AMP that I still see is the URL. I've been told this is a problem of web standards, that to make AMP serve as fast as it does, this was part of your problem, Leo, originally. It does serve from Google's CDN, its content delivery network, but it serves under a Google URL.
Right.
Because otherwise, if it tried to mimic the creator's URL, then security would say, oh, that looks funny to us. And so there isn't a good way yet to fix that. So AMP does look like it all comes through Google, even though it's still the publisher's ads, and AMP has nothing around that. They're both a little creaky. I think they're both trying to... They're trying to solve problems that should be solved otherwise.
With better websites?
Yeah, we just screwed up the web. And then in terms of instant articles, I do like it. But I've said to folks at Facebook over the last year or so, don't play to our worst egotistical instincts, which is that everything's an article.
Right.
Make us, force us like Snapchat to rethink the form of news that's appropriate to the platform. I did see, however, I don't know if you saw today that there's the rundown. There's a new light version of Twitter. I couldn't get it to work based on progressive web apps, which is AMP Plus more functionality, which is really interesting to see. That's the first effort I've really seen it break out of the Google world. I think that's cool.
Go ahead, the light Twitter is just mobile Twitter optimized a bit.
It was intended for low bandwidth phones.
Low bandwidth, but it's PWA. Yeah. It's still progressive web apps, which is an add-on.
Progressive web app, but it's not AMP.
An add-on to AMP. PWA is an add-on to AMP.
PWA is
what? No, it isn't.
Okay.
PWA is initiative to have web apps that behave like mobile apps. And it's led by the Chrome team at Google. They pushed it very strongly. AMP is a parallel thing led by a different group at Google. And they do interoperate well because, you know, they made it work. But PWA doesn't have anything to do with AMP directly.
When the Washington Post demonstrated PWA, it was heavily using AMP.
Yes, yeah. And they've abandoned that one, which is kind of annoying.
It is annoying because it was a great app.
Yeah.
I don't know where it goes, Leo. I'm not sure. I think that I think what's happening with the New York Times leaving instant articles is they're trying to negotiate for more revenue on the pages. The thing I've heard from publishers is some publishers say this should equal what the web does, my own site does, and other publishers, smart publishers, say no, it's new traffic and new revenue, and it beats my programmatic ads, and I like that. So it depends on your expectations to a great extent.
I mean, the interesting thing for me has been seeing what AMP has done to encourage newspapers to not be bloated in the first place. They've basically taken, they've built the AMP version, and then they go, wait, why is our main site so bad compared to this? And then they're actually able to get executives to listen to, you need to stop injecting, you know, gigabytes of junk into the page for advertising.
The other problem is trying to get the advertisers to clean up their act.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that was a fascinating topic. Next, Leo.
The birthday girl's bored.
We got to move on. Come on.
I'm just
a minute on Twitter Lite. So Twitter Lite is interesting. So one of the things when I moved here initially, I didn't have a local SIM, so I was using the T-Mobile, you know, throttled down to 2G bandwidth.
It's very slow.
Did the thing.
Yeah.
And when I was doing that, I noticed how much better that all these progressive web app and AMP related things were than either local apps or the websites. They didn't lock the phone up anywhere near as much. And
really? So even the local apps were slower than the progressive. Progressive apps are apps that load in bit by bit from the net.
Yes. Well, because, you know, this was true of web apps a lot anyway, because the web is designed to load asynchronously, whereas a lot of mobile apps are effectively a browser that only works on one domain. But they don't have the sort of subtle asynchrony that web apps do. So they assume there's a lot of bandwidth there, and they just sit there and lock up and take a long time to load. And it's noticeable if I'm on that connection that the mobile Twitter site is way better than the mobile Twitter app. Like, you know, like significantly faster and more responsive.
For the first time ever, an advertisement has intentionally triggered a voice assistant. Intentionally. We do it by accident all the time. Now, if you've got a Google Home, go ahead, Jeff, put your Google Home up next to the speaker.
What's funny is
this Burger King ad doesn't do what it was trying to do. So maybe they didn't expect it to work. They just thought it'd make everybody laugh.
You're watching a 15-second Burger King ad, which is unfortunately not enough time to explain all the fresh ingredients in the Whopper sandwich. But I got an idea. What is the Whopper burger?
Wow. According to Wikipedia, the Whopper is a hamburger consisting of a flame-grilled quarter-pound beef patty, sesame seed bun, mayonnaise, lettuce, tomato, pickles, ketchup, and sliced onion.
Oh, it did work.
It did work.
Now, I thought Google had... Okay, so here's what I... Here, this story, like, evolving, and I feel, like, so played by, conglomerates here, but they said...
Yes.
Wikipedia was edited to change the top section of it, for a while. And they were like, did Burger King do it? Did someone else do it? Okay, so was that Prankster or Burger King? The other thing then was that I had seen that Google had stopped that from working, but clearly, Jeff, yours
just
didn't.
Yeah. So it looks like Burger King is behind the Wikipedia edit because the line was added by somebody with a username Fermachado123. Burger King's marketing chief is Fernando Machado, and he uses Fermachado123 on Instagram and a very similar name on Twitter. So
I still feel like I'm being played.
You are being played, but not by Google, by Burger King.
This is like, okay, so this is why voice authentication needs to come sooner rather than later.
And also, by the way, The Verge modified the Wikipedia entry and the Google Home said the new entry. So, you know, if I were Burger King, I'd be very nervous at this point. We should check.
Well, read the other story. Yeah, read the other story. No, it got far worse. The one right there on the rundown.
Oh, okay. So it this
toenail
is
toenail clippings. The Whopper is made of toenail clippings.
Oh my
cyanide.
God.
Yes, so, because the Wikipedia was adapted and the voice comes from Wikipedia.
Now they've fixed it, and I would guess Wikipedia has locked it down, although oddly they've locked it with the promotional copy.
Well, of course they did.
Well, but Wikipedia doesn't take ads. That's very interesting.
It's not inaccurate. I mean, the Whopper and
it's not made of nail clippings. That's inaccurate.
And cyanide.
So yes. Like if it said it's a delicious burger with lightly toasted sesame seeds.
That's true. It is just mere fact. Yeah.
But
by the way, Burger King got what it really wanted, which is all this social media play.
You're welcome, Burger King. Here we are.
I'm craving a Whopper right now.
Better than Chipotle, Burger King. You can buy an ad on this very show. We'll play your ad.
Well, I'll eat Whoppers if you want during the show.
not if it's in the wrong 36 hours.
Not on my fast days. Yeah, no, right. but isn't that interesting? And I wonder if we'll see more of that.
Right? That'd be a better commercial, Leo. You're on your fast day and they start. Carson runs the Whopper under your nose to torture you.
Shaking. Isn't that funny?
It irritates. It feels you. Like we're going to be like people were saying, apparently when I did my little birthday thing, they were like, oh, you triggered my Echo, you know? And I'm like, oops, it's a dick move to trigger someone's voice activated speaker.
Intentionally. It is absolutely
intentionally.
It's easy enough to do accidentally.
Yes.
In fact, it goes back to Aaron Paul. There was an Xbox ad where the actor from Breaking Bad issued some Xbox commands, and quite famously, because many had their Xbox hooked up to their television set. And so when he issued the command in the Xbox ad, it took over the TV and you no longer were watching the ad. That was an unintended consequence.
Like bad advertising.
I think this is quite clever. I wonder what Google will do to keep it from happening again. I guess there's nothing they can do. You're right. No. The one solution, Stacey, is voice authentication training.
Or you could do, like, didn't we have a whole, I feel like, am I hallucinating this conversation? But we had a whole thing about frequencies that you could play underneath.
Yeah, we talked about it. And I annoyed everybody by playing a 5 kilohertz tone.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
The show, and everybody was getting very upset.
Oh, yeah, you really pissed off everybody below a certain age.
It seems like that's my new thing. I pissed off everybody last week because I was so clueless about the Pepsi commercial. Stacey had explained it all to me.
And I was not the best user or best person to explain it. So, sorry.
Well, I think you did a fine job. And I kind of stand by my, let's not bring it up again.
I was going to say, hey, let's talk about
it. Leo just loves to shoot himself in the foot.
So did you see the data also right underneath that is the data on the Pepsi ad? Turns out it was a pretty effective ad.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I mean, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
No.
So where is that?
The data? If you go down to the charts,
A lot of people kind of like the Pepsi ad.
So look at this. Hispanic Americans, 75% left more favorable than not. Black Americans, 51%. White Americans, 41%. Were more favorable toward Pepsi after watching the video than before.
Hmm. So all that, it's kind of underscores my point, which is all the outrage that you saw on Twitter wasn't universal outrage. It was just
nothing on Twitter is universal.
Yeah, well, that's my point.
That's the other problem,
and news
right.
organizations should stop treating it as anything but just this, you know, tiny little microcosm. Not so tiny. 310.
Not so tiny. It's pretty big.
310 million monthly active users is pretty big.
That's how many people are in the U.S.
Yeah, I know. I know. I know. So why did Ev Williams sell 30% of his stock? I ask you that.
Good question.
But actually, a bigger question is why.
Did you do that recently?
Yeah, last week.
Oh, okay.
But he says, I just wanted to cash out. But here's the bigger question. When Adam Bain and Adam Messenger left, they left $35 million in unexercised options behind.
Well, were the options above water?
Yeah. This I was questioning the story because I was like, were they worth anything or would they just have to wait for them maybe to be worth something?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a bunch of exercise options in Technorati that I've got to sort of say worth nothing, you know.
Well, that's
interesting. Technorati's still alive.
Kinda. It got sold to someone else this year and they helpfully mailed us all and said, hi, you get nothing.
It's now it's a Citicorp brand.
It still vaguely exists and is still vaguely doing something, but I'm not quite sure what.
Excellent description.
But yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I think it's basically coasting on the Google juice it got from when it was actually useful. But that's probably a little mean to say, but hey, you know, I don't owe them anything anymore.
Well, the stock that they left behind obviously hadn't been vested or they would have exercised it before they left. So,
yeah, so
they would have had to stay there longer to exercise it. I don't know
No. If it's vested, you've still got to pay to exercise it. So
yes.
If they had options that the strike price was above the current price, then it would cost the money to get the stock.
Right, so
they
understand that. But 75% of them had not vested.
Yes, but the thing is, if they have vested, you've still
even
got
then
to
they're
the
not
money.
Worth anything. I understand. What
at
you're
that
saying.
Point, you've, yeah. you've still got to, you've got to come up with a big chunk of cash
right.
at the exact point when you're
and
leaving a company.
You may have a tax hit that wipes out all your gains and ends up costing you money.
Yeah.
So, this is why stock options, like, they're not worth anything until they're actually worth something, and then you better cash in as fast as possible and take your tax hit. I mean,
but that is the right way to do it. The stupid thing to do is where you exercise your stock options on the assumption the stock is still going up and then get the tax, realize the tax liability,
right.
and then don't sell them, and then you're already screwed. And that, a lot of people
can't
have done
you,
that.
Can't you... Won't a brokerage loan you the money to exercise if you sell right away?
Yeah, no, if you... Yes.
You don't have to have that cash. Here, let me write you a check so you can give me a bigger check.
Yeah, if you exercise and sell right away, yes, then you can do that in one transaction.
Right.
And then sell it and you put some aside for the tax and it works. So there's, right. if there's a profit.
As long as you're not underwater, which as far... I mean, I don't know. It doesn't say what the strike price was on these options. But my sense is it wasn't underwater. Because they were worth something, $35 million to be exact. They just hadn't vested.
Okay. Well, if they haven't vested, they don't exist.
They don't exist unless they stay there. And that's the point. By leaving.
Yeah, but that's looking at a sunk. That's a potential sunk.
Right.
That's not even a sunk. I
well,
mean, like,
and maybe that made him, maybe Adam and Adam kind of had an idea that maybe that stock price
wasn't
going up.
The right way.
It could have been. Could have been.
The biggest indicator here is they're like, you know what? We don't believe in this company, so we're leaving, and we don't care that we're walking away from...
Right. A potential $35 million.
Yeah. A possible chunk of
change. Now, I should point out, they made $14 million between them. So
they're doing okay.
They're not... Your good news is they can have as many Whoppers as they want. U.S. government ceases fire and legal spat with Twitter. That was a fun one. The so remember the rogue alt-USCIS account?
Yes, this was good.
This is actually quite funny. It was it was one of the many government alt accounts. It was USCIS is the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, and the White House did not like the things they were saying. Now, I have to admit, there's things said all the time on Twitter that I don't like, but what I don't do is then issue a summons. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection issued a summons, and the funniest part is it was such a poorly written summons. First of all, it was backdated a month. It had the wrong date on it and said they had to respond within a few days, but it was last month. And then they cited U.S. Code Section 1509, which gives them the right to issue a subpoena to investigate the taxation of imported goods. They don't, in fact, have subpoena power having to do with Twitter and free speech or anything like that. So it was a completely bogus summons, which Twitter quite rightly not only fought but went to court and countersued with the help of the ACLU. And
you know what? When I ran local sites,
yeah,
the summonses we got more than anything else were from police departments, police chiefs trying to find out the IP addresses of the cops who were complaining about them in our forums.
Sorry.
You can't say that about me.
Yeah.
So they were informed that the summons probably wasn't such a good summons, and that they probably didn't have the best, you know, optical. It didn't look good for a federal government to try to get somebody for saying bad things about them. So they withdrew, and Twitter voluntarily dismissed their suit.
Didn't we have an act on our books? Was it Treason and Sedition Act back in 17 something?
Yeah, that's used often against hackers nowadays.
It's still there?
It's the reason Edward Snowden can't come home.
Oh,
one of the features of the Sedition and Treason Act is that you can't testify on your behalf. You can't. I can't remember the deal, but. We talked to Edward Snowden's lawyer. By the way, a fine episode of Triangulation, which is nominated for a Webby Award, and I sure would appreciate it if you voted for it. So watch that episode. But he talks about
it. I will now.
Yeah. Snowden said, I can't come back because I wouldn't get a fair trial. And the reason he wouldn't get a fair trial is because the rules of this act from the 18th century prevent him from mounting a defense. Actually, I'm sorry. It's not the Sedition and Treason. It's the 1917 Espionage Act.
Yes.
Sorry. Oh, okay. I got it wrong. It's the same.
So, is the treason? I thought the treason.
Sedition and treason, is that gone?
Thank you. I thought that was.
Oh, that was a very famous act. Yes, that's right. It was, yes. In fact, it's quoted in Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States is an example of how little the First Amendment was respected by the founders. Because right after they created the Bill of Rights, they also passed the Sedition and Treason Act.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yes. Right.
Boy, your history's good, Stacey. Wow.
No.
So
I'm just closer to my classes.
That's right. So now you've backhandedly said I'm old, but that's okay.
Oh,
The Sedition and Treason Act actually was a prior restraint, right? They could throw them in jail if they were going to publish.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. It was really friendly. It kind of, I feel like we might be coming back to that given the relationship.
We could be. So the Espionage Act, I'm looking at Glenn Greenwald's article. I guess just it makes the essence of it is that anyway, he can't have a fair trial, he feels, because of the rules of the way he'd be prosecuted. I can't find it here, but I will leave that as an exercise for the reader.
Do we want to talk about Amazon streaming 4K video from space? Because I'm really curious about how that's going to happen.
That'll be neat.
Or we can talk about Bezos and
no, let's do that, and then
space.
We'll do and then do a Bezos. Cool. He's selling a lot of stock, $1 billion a year.
Oh, Bezos! Yeah, I just saw his annual letter is hilarious. Where does
he can afford, by the way, to sell $1 billion a year of stock and not really put a dent in his fortune?
Yes, he also told people that it's going to be so fast that there won't be a bathroom on the ship. So.
Oh, okay. So
that doesn't work for guys with prostate cancer.
That's the blue ocean.
Blue Origin.
They're going to have, in the long run, they plan to be doing real space stuff. But in the interim, they're going to do space tourism where you'll go up and down.
I would pay a lot of money to go and see the Earth from space.
How much is a lot of money?
Well, I don't have that much money, so
that's the
obviously
problem. You can say that all you want.
Well, because SpaceX have got people going around the moon, which is I suspect a sort of Haha, we can do that. You can't do it.
Well, it's two people, and I think it's pretty clear one of them is going to be Elon. He won't say it's not.
That's fair.
It's fair.
I mean,
you can't buy it. The other one's Sergey.
Yeah, it's going to be somebody like that. Yeah,
I could totally see Sergey.
Yeah. So Bezos was speaking at a conference. He said the trip on his company's New Shepard's tourist spacecraft will be so quick that you better go to the bathroom in advance. The whole thing from boarding until you're back on the ground is probably 40 or 41 minutes. We don't have to put a bathroom in other words.
Wow. So it's actually less time than you get on the Vomit Comet.
Really? You get more than 40 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes about 90 minutes, but you get a total of, I can't remember exactly how much free fall you get.
Right. I wonder, he hasn't said how much this will cost, right?
No.
It's really an amusement park ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Here's the, let me show
Disney
you the,
gone mad.
This is the picture of what you'll be sitting in.
It's very
wow. It looks like a big Echo.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're riding a giant Echo.
Hello, take me to the moon. Oh, I'm sorry, you guys.
That's okay. I don't think anybody's going to the moon. What we don't know, he's taking out $1 billion every year for the next few years to finance this and selling in stock. What we don't know is how much this trip will cost. Has he 6 tourists? No bathroom, as you can see. Bezos is worth $75 billion. So, you know, billion here, billion there. What's the big deal? Here he is in front of the vehicle. he said the flight is so short, no one will want to use their valuable time in the bathroom.
That's probably true.
But that wasn't the story. That's a good story. Nothing wrong with that story, but that's not the 4K story. The NASA and Amazon Web Services on April 26th, so mark your calendar. You're going to want to see this, John. Come over to my house. I have a 4K TV. We'll watch it together. Are going to broadcast. This is the first time a 4K stream has been sent from space. It'll be 10:30 a.m. Pacific on the 26th. It's going to be for NAB. They're going to show it at NAB.
Oh, wow.
And then you'll be able to watch it as a 4K recording after the fact on NASA's website. How are they doing it?
Really streaming 4K? Because getting from, I mean, the internet in space is terrible. It's high latency, low bandwidth. It's not good.
Well, wait a minute, though. Remember, it's a one-way.
You can actually point
a
microwave dish.
Yeah, it's a one-way stream. It's not, the latency doesn't matter. You're sending it down.
Okay.
And SkyTV have been doing this for a while. It's sending videos from geostationary orbit is kind of a thing.
You could send, as you say, microwave. You've got good line of sight. You send it down, and microwave can carry a lot of bandwidth, right? Tons of bandwidth.
Yes.
I mean, the challenge is low Earth orbit because they're moving fast, right? Geostationary is easy because they're stationary.
They have to aim the microwave beam very carefully.
Whereas this will involve like a bunch of ground stations handing over, which is what makes it difficult. Unless they're going to send it out to geostationary and back down again. It's not clear.
See, this was my question. I was like, this is awesome. I'm sure it's going to be gorgeous. But how the heck are they streaming 4K from space? I can't even get 4K and I'm on the ground.
That's pretty cool. It's a good bit. It's a good publicity piece for Amazon Web Services, right? So if you're going to NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas this year, you're going to want to go to the Reaching for the Stars Super Session, Connecting to the Future with NASA and Hollywood. And that's where they're going to show it. That's worth going to NAB for, actually. Let's go.
NAB is not a bad show. I mean,
yeah, we used to cover it every year. Every year.
I used to go to NAB when I was
at. You went. You covered it?
Oh, yeah, we covered it. We had a booth there for many years. Well, because a lot of technology is announced there, particularly the kinds of technology I'm interested in, cameras and microphones.
Streaming. Television,
that kind of stuff. As you know.
When I was at Apple on QuickTime, we used to go every year, and they used to send the engineers because it was the best opportunity for us to listen to the video professionals and what they actually wanted in QuickTime. The entire engineering team would man the booth. That was how we did it.
So, Jeff gave me this link to Jeff Bezos' yearly letter to shareholders. Should I read this, Jeff?
So, Jeff, what does day two look like? Because evidently the office building he's in is called day one. When he moved the name. So he's explaining day two is stasis, followed by irrelevance, followed by excruciating, painful decline, followed by death. And that is why it is always day one.
Wow.
I love that.
Wow.
Werner Vogel shared that. It's a Bezosian.
That's a very Bezosian. Yeah. That's pretty funny.
He must be exhausting.
He might, there, you know, bingo. He must be exhausting. It'd be like being, you know, like hanging out with Robin Williams or something. Just might, it's just like,
yeah, he drags you to the edge of every capability you have, and then he comes out with that amazing hyena laugh.
Yeah.
And then Kevin sent me a YouTube
video. I
really
want to go to space. So I made my own astronaut training program because nobody else would have me. I'm like a pet up for adoption, and I just decided to adopt myself. I've already made sure that I won't throw up and I won't go crazy.
So this is the vomit comet she's going to do?
Weighing me down. The biggest downer.
Yes, you know Simone, right? You've seen her.
Freaking
before.
Gravity.
I don't know her. Who is this?
Oh my.
She's awesome.
It's Simone Gertz.
Yes. She's the queen of shitty robots. She basically made all those robots.
Oh, yeah, that's her. Oh, we love her. Yes.
She can float in it and experience what it's like to be weightless. You ready for this?
She's a YouTube star.
My jumpsuit game is like an onion. This is like layers upon layers.
So now she's going to the spa for some reason.
Yeah, so she ends up going to the... Did I get the right one?
Oh, this is. Oh, I know what this is. This is suspension tanks.
Yeah, I did that. I did a column on that in San Francisco years and years and years ago.
Yeah, this used to be all the rage, right? Yeah, Altered States. Yeah,
you
get in there and you're floating, and then they close the lid and you can't see anything, and it's a sensory deprivation tank. They call it. I like that it has a big on-off button right on the front there. It looks like a Macintosh egg. Okay.
All right, now I'm bored.
Okay, I'm bored to tears. This is why I don't watch YouTube, frankly. I don't.
I was trying to. I
I'm sure this is the right one.
Okay.
No, because now she's in the vomit comet. She gets to do this. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
And by the way, do you really want to be in a room with 20 people called the Vomit Comet?
No.
Floating? Really? Do they check to see if you're going to vomit before you go up? And then how long is it, the period of weightlessness? Is 15 seconds, 20 seconds?
It's a several 30-second burst.
It's pretty long. But they added it together so you feel like you're weightless for a long time, but you're not because at some
point... She shows you like the experience of going to the ground and coming
there
up.
There you go. Yeah.
If they put a window in that thing, you'd truly vomit.
Yeah.
So OK Go did it better. That's all I'm going to say.
I am going to, you know, it's I'm doing it right now because you inspired me. This is OK Go does the best music videos ever. We've had them on actually to talk about some of them. This one they did in the vomit comic.
Absolutely insane. But they booked it for a solid week to do this, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They had to rehearse and like crazy because, well, you'll see why in a second. Because they can only do it 30 seconds at a time, right? So this entire video is shot in 30-second increments. And it doesn't look like they're weightless, but they obviously they are. Yeah. It's pretty well done.
Super well done. I showed it to my daughter, and she didn't know what to expect. And when he did that, she was just like,
Whoa! But see, now you've got to
use that against United Airlines.
Now you got to cut because you know, they have to freeze, and then the plane has to go up in the air again to another parabola. And these guys work so hard in their videos. I just don't.
I have no sense of how good music is.
Right. Music's only mediocre. These guys became famous with the treadmill video.
Which was
a very clever video. This was they were just starting out. That was about, I think we showed that on Tech TV, so 15 years ago, I guess. It can't have been that long ago. Did someone die inside? So, right, you're right. The music is secondary. But I
now
like
these
them.
These guys must have such a hard time because you've got to... Got to top themselves every single time.
It's got to be hard, right? It's got to be so hard.
Is this an interview I just put up?
We'll look now. We interviewed them on the this two. The, this two should be.
We did.
Not this. Oh, what is this now? This is the United Airlines drag defense.
Yeah.
This is something everybody ought to learn here.
As a jiu-jitsu instructor, you guys know I couldn't make this video without providing some very effective Gracie drag defenses for men, women, and children, whether you're getting dragged off a plane or through a Dollar General store. The secret is to get your legs between you and the attacker.
Oh, God. There are endless possibilities. If only he had done that. He kicks the guy in the face. He does a scissor.
He's out. If he's standing a little bit taller, place both feet on the hips, elevate, rotate, drop, and lock. Helicopter.
I wish Dr. Dow had had these techniques to hand.
Just connect, rotate, double ankle pick.
Actually, for all we know, he did, because didn't he escape from the police officers and run back onto the plane?
Yeah. Last but not least, if you have a change of heart during your drag defense and you actually want to give your seat to the United employee, simply put them to sleep, tuck them in, and get off the plane before they wake up.
Wow. United Airlines drag defense by Renner and Ryron Gracie.
If we talk about this goes back. I read this. I put a link in the show notes. This was a very nice, and it'll fit with Leo, your hatred of all things Twitter and kind of the idea of lazy journalism. But and I did notice this too when I was reading the United coverage. People couldn't decide if the plane was overbooked or if it was, you know, they wanted the employees to take the ride or what was going on. And so this person broke it down, talking to some aviation lawyers about what happened, and really kind of excoriated the media for their coverage.
It's been hot and cold.
It has been really.
You don't drag people out of a plane like that. At some point,
there had to be a better way.
Not the way we treat.
There had to be a better way than doing that. Nobody denies that United had the right to do that.
So the point, though, is if you're a journalist, you have to, like, I totally believe you have to get beyond, hey, this terrible thing happened.
Yes, no, yeah. I agree.
Yes, you're right.
And that's fine for your first take.
Even on the PBS NewsHour, it was the headlines. Yeah, and a man was dragged off a United Airlines plane. They didn't even mention that it was Republic, that it was a United Express plane. And anyway, it'll be fun to watch the lawsuit develop.
Yeah, I mean, but you're, Stacey, you're right. There were issues. There was another plane on the other end that wouldn't have taken off, and all those people would have been inconvenienced if that crew hadn't gotten there.
Yeah, all of that's true, but there had to be a better way. That was a
there had to be a better
United
way.
United's at some point going to pay a huge price. They've already lost several hundred million dollars in their stock price.
This is not how a company operates. It's a terrible culture. Somewhere the pilot should have come off and said, no, we don't treat our people that way.
The CEO, finally, after 3 days, he said, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, it took Sean Spicer more times to apologize for Holocaust centers. So I figure the new standard, you know, is in good shape.
Is it just coincidence, or I think we've reached critical mass of Twitter outrage because we got the Pepsi thing, we got the Sean Spicer thing, and we got the United thing. Those are all happened in a space of a few days. Is this not going to happen now from now on? Like every week there'll be a new outrage.
Yeah, this is. I still like Twitter. I still get a lot of great stuff on it. I'm not going to be switching to Mastodon anytime soon because I'm not technically savvy enough.
I wouldn't switch to Mastodon. All right, let's talk about Mastodon. Kevin Marks, apparently, which I didn't realize, had introduced Mastodon in October on this show. I actually went back and watched the tape.
November.
So this is simply a Ruby on Rails interface to something called OStatus. And you all know OStatus because we had an OStatus Identica server, the Twit Army, in 2008, which I set up taking great pains with Evan Prodromu, the guy who wrote Identica. Identica became, and correct me when I go wrong on this, Kevin, because it's...
Sure.
Identica became status.net. I think Evan sold it. And then...
He still owns status.net, but he just changed the name.
Okay, he changed the name. Go ahead.
Carry on, sorry. So Status.net was the company he was trying to commercialize it with.
He was trying to make another Twitter. He literally was trying to make another Twitter.
Well, he made another Twitter. He made, you know, he made a thing that worked, but he built it on top of open source MSN, which was interesting. Yeah, interesting, good work. So OStatus was his name for the collection of specs that he used in it, which are Atom for the feeds, PubSub Hubbub, which is now called WebSub, and went to candidate recommendation in W3C this week, which is the way you notify people as soon as you've updated. So that's how you get the real-time updates.
The push technology.
Yes. Yes, effectively, that's the push technology. And then the two other components that were incorporated were Webfinger, which was it's a slightly overcomplicated way of looking up username at domain. And there was a protocol that was put together to let you look up usernames and domains that involves doing three or four fetches from the site and doing a bunch of stuff to look it up and then deciding where the domain is. Whereas actually just saying domain at username works on these instances just as easily. But this was there's a protocol for doing that, and it lets you get a bunch of endpoints without fetching the page. So it makes us. It's one of these protocols where we built this complicated thing, and then we went, "That's more complicated than we need it to be," and it's sort of mostly rotted. But
but you never replaced it or did anything else with it. You let it lie there.
This is the thing about standards open source. You make a standard, people can still implement it. You create an open source implementation, people can still build on that. So StatusNet et al. Became GNU Social, which has been. You know, it's been maintained. People have running instances of that for a long time.
Yeah, you told us about that maybe a year or two ago. In fact, because of you, I signed up for one of the GNU Social instances, Quitter.no, which looks just like Twitter.
So this is the thing. So GNU Social, like core GNU Social, looks more like a blogging system. And the Quitter thing, Quitter.se was the first one. They gave it this Twitter-like skin, which was built. This was built 4 years ago, maybe. And it looks like old Twitter. It doesn't look like current Twitter, but it looks like Twitter looked like in 2010.
Which a lot of people like.
Yeah. No. And but also it means that people who are used to Twitter, like Stacey, doesn't want to deal with this stuff, can go, oh, I know how to use this. Right. It looks familiar. Right. And it kind of works. And then you go, but it doesn't quite work the same as Twitter. What's going on? There's some other
And the big problem with it, of course, is, as you can see, I'm following four people, one of whom is Kevin Marks. The other one's Cory Doctorow. I mean, it's very geeky, and it was cool though. I like it, and I've maintained my account. And then you told us about Gargron, who real name, by the way. That's his handle.
His name is Eugene. Yeah, but he's he reimplemented it from scratch in a different. You know, he built it. The classic ones in PHP and runs the LAMP stack. He rebuilt it in Ruby on Rails using a React front end. And his front end looks more like TweetDeck. So the Mastodon front end has this multi-column thing going on. So you've got four columns.
You can see it here. And by the way, it has a limit of 500 characters. So I stretched this to show how you can make a long post. You can also put in images. It has some nice features. You can choose per post privacy, kind of like Facebook, unlike Twitter, direct, private to followers only, unlisted, does not show on public timelines. You can also put in a content warning. So don't look at this, and then put something in there. And so this is really handy. In fact, people have used it, interestingly, for political posts. Like you type... Yes. Politics, and then say something political, and people who didn't want to see it wouldn't have to see it. Yeah. So I'll toot that. It's called a toot, not a tweet. And you see that the toot here says politics, and then show more button. I like that. The columns are home. This is the people I follow. This is like the Twitter home column. Mm-hmm. Notifications also very much like Twitter with some of the same kind of controls. You can choose what you see in the notifications column. It's where you get interesting is in this third column, Kevin. It's the it could either be the local timeline or the federated timeline. Tell us about that.
Okay, so the way this works is the first column is the people you've chosen to follow. The local timeline is everyone who's on the same instance as you are.
So we better explain federation and instances then.
Yes. So in a way, it's like an old group blog from 2002 or so, where we would all sign into the same blog and have a conversation on that blog because communication between blog was awkward. So when you sign into a Mastodon instance, anyone you refer to with an app will be on the same instance as you, and you can have conversations between them. And it feels like
it's Twitter. If there was only one, there's only one Twitter. That's it. You're in that silo, right?
But it's also, you know, like, you know, a lot of Known runs this way as well. So one of the things that Known has built with Known is doing this kind of site for education, where you will set up a site for your whole class and they'll have a conversation within the site, even though they connect outside the site as well. So it's a sort of similar idea of giving you a sort of peer group to connect to. So the local timeline is the set of people who are on the same server as you, who've signed up for the same one. So the Mastodon Social was the initial one that Eugene set up, but there's a bunch of other ones that have been set up over the last couple of weeks that have different themes and different people.
Think of it like email. So you could be on Yahoo yes. Mail, and I'd be Leo at Yahoo Mail. I could also have Leo at Gmail. And they're federated, so I can send a message from Gmail to Yahoo Mail. So it's kind of right. like that, right? So if I were just, this is like local timelines, just people on Yahoo Mail, and the federated timeline is other Mastodon instances. How many? There are 1,000 now, a couple of thousand now, right?
I'm not sure exactly how many, though.
It's growing like Topsy. It became very popular.
There's a few hundred Mastodons. There's a few hundred GNU Social ones, and they interoperate as well. They federate between them.
Not thousands.
So the local timeline is everyone who's on the same server as you and what they're saying. And then the federated timeline is everyone who's on the same server as you plus all the people they follow from other servers.
So it's not the total universe, but just people followed yes. by people on your server.
Yes. So it's like one degree of a friend of a friend.
Right. There's no way to follow the total timeline.
No.
Okay.
Well, not without running a crawler.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you get the fire hose? Could you get the whole fire hose?
Theoretically, you'd have to subscribe to every user in every instance.
Some instances are trying to do this. They're creating follow bots, which go out and try to follow. It's almost like crawling Mastodon. They try to follow everything they can find. And then that way, your federated timeline, if you're on that particular instance, would be approximation of the total universe.
And, you know, you could write it, you know, I built the technology thing that did this for blogs. You can write a crawler that crawls everything and tries to collect it all, but you're going to be investing a lot of money on servers to do that.
Yeah.
But the point of this is so the way to think about this is nobody can read the whole of Twitter either. That's an impossibility. Now, in 2007, you could. In 2007, Twitter had a public timeline that was everything that everyone posted ever. And it was one of the choices on the front page, and they turned that off after a while because it would go past so fast you couldn't read it, and it became unusable. And so what the goal of the local timeline is to give you a subset of that, and then and also it's relatively cheap to produce because they're all on the same machine. And then the federated timeline here, or the whole node network as they call it in GNU Social, is one step beyond that. A step further. But if you go to a different instance, you will see a different, you know, federated timeline, because it depends on whose people on that instance have followed as well. So you know, you're on two instances, so you can switch between it and see different things on those two.
There were a number of articles in the last couple of weeks. Lance Ulanoff wrote one saying, forget it, this thing's going to die. In fact, that's the obvious thing to say is, oh, we've seen this all before, which we have.
Of course we have. I mean,
So what? And then another kind of straw man raised is, well, it's not going to replace Twitter. But I don't think that's the intent. In fact, one of the reasons I use it, it has kind of replaced Twitter for me, because the conversations are very nice and pleasant and geeky, and I have a great time talking to people.
You're talking to what, 5-6 people?
Oh, no, it's more than that. But it's, you know, it's not... Well, it's not you, Jeff, and it's not Stacy. Kevin's
it's a
there.
Few hundred.
Yeah. There are, I think, 100-some thousand people.
Right. So here's the thing. So I saw Dave Weiner at the conference I was at last week, and I said, Dave, what happened to blogging? At the early, early days of blogging, it really was wonderful. I met all these people who thought differently from me and from around the world. And we all saw our differences, and we all got along. And, yeah, we disagreed, but it was basically civil. And Dave said, everything's nice when it starts.
Right. That's why I like it.
Yeah. Right.
Fresh, shiny, new.
So
there is, it does have some features that might help with abuse. For one thing, it's not some faceless person at Twitter that's deciding what's abuse, right? It's the person who runs the instance.
Yes. So, that's interesting.
So you've got some separate controls. So you could set up a CUNY instance and make it about what you're talking about, what your conversation is, and you can decide who you federate with and who you show on the public timeline, who you block completely.
So apparently there are some Nazi Mastodon, you know, white supremacist Mastodon instances, but nobody federates with them. So in effect, they have a nice local thing, and you don't see it.
And they plot revolution on their own.
Right.
Well, this is what happened with Quitter in the first place. So if you remember, Quitter.se got a huge influx of users for one Twitter furore, whatever. At some point, Twitter banned somebody, and the sort of alt-right types said, we need something better than this, and they turned up at Quitter.se, and the Swedish guy who ran it was like, no, actually, I'm a communist, and he put the Communist Manifesto on the front page, said, if you want to set up your own alt-right instance, I'll show you how to do that, but you really shouldn't be on this one because you won't fit in. And there was, you know, Instapundit went there for a bit, and there was a sort of little rebellion thing going on there. And then they set up, what's that thing called? There's some annoying, like, frog-themed Twitter-alike thing that doesn't federate properly and is trying to be its own thing. So that they ended up there instead. And, you know, there are other social instances that have, you know, like a strong, what they call, their point of view is, we are strongly free speech, and that they don't take into account that speech can hurt people. And so that they're sort of anti-censorship in that sense. So that they're in the sort of ACLU at Skokie School of Free Speech, as opposed to that actually suppresses certain kinds of speech things. So there are instances that have different moderation policies, and then there are rules about who federates with whom and debates about what's going on there. So there is a lot of that kind of who federates with whom drama going on as well. The interesting thing that happened with Mastodon Social is that the people who turned up there, and there's been influx of different groups of people, have spent a bunch of time saying, well, what would it be like? You know, the reason it's got these kinds of features of being able to put content warning and things like that was that Eugene listened to the people who turned up and said, wouldn't it be nice if we had this? And he said, well, we could do that. Maybe try that and see if that works. And he spent a lot of time doing that kind of community management stuff and listening to what people have built. And I think I linked an article about this that was, where did I put this? Somewhere in the, it's in the Mastodon.
So we were
section.
Thinking of doing, for instance, No Agenda's already done one, Adam Curry and John Dvorak's show. We were thinking of doing a Twit instance. So the local Twit instance would be people, like you see in the chat room, our hosts and so forth, communicating. And if you didn't want to see anything but that, you would never look at the federated timeline. You would never follow anybody outside the timeline. And you would just be in that little, tight little community. You could peek out if you want. And so it's kind of a nice mixture of private and public. I'm fascinated by it, mostly because it's not siloed. There's lots of other issues. For instance, you don't own your name in any respect, which has actually been a good thing. It's kept most of the brands out. You know, so The Verge can register, as they have, an account on one instance, but there could be a Verge on every single instance because the namespace is the instance name. So I'm at Leo at Mastodon.network, but I'm also at Leo at Mastodon.social, and I'm also at Leo, Leo Laporte at Twitter.no. Oh. I only use one of those, but if I start a Twit instance, I could also be at Leo at twit.twit.tv.
But somebody else could be at Leo at my Mastodon.
No, you post the one, and you say, on all the other ones, you say, follow me. This is my canonical one. Wait a minute, you have multiple email addresses, right? And you tell people which email address works.
But there's imposters.
Yes, but I don't.
Yes, there could be imposters. There's no verification system.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't want to invest the time in managing that.
Hand raised. So the point is, you could verify this stuff. I've built this. You can do distributed verification. You linked it between them with RealmEase, and you can see which one is connected to the other ones. And that's actually better than a verification that depends on the site owner deciding.
You can verify yourself. There's also an ad hoc verification system. A number of us on Keybase have used Keybase things to ad hoc verifiers selves. So you could verify that's Leo because it's on his Keybase page.
But this is the point. The point is that you have a username at a domain, which is like having a blog at a domain, or like having a Tumblr thing with a username, or it's like having an email address. What you don't have is a global namespace, because the global namespace would imply there's only one instance. And so,
which I like.
This is what was annoying me about Lance. You know, it's like, you can't have a global namespace. This will die. It's like, no. Actually, the things that don't have global namespace are things that don't die. The ones that have a single namespace are the ones that die. And if you don't believe me, I've got a page full of them at indieweb.org/sitedeaths. You know, there's... So you know the idea of anti-fragility? Anti-fragility says if you build something that can cope with bad things happening to it, it gets stronger over time and it becomes anti-fragile. And the web is something that is anti-fragile. The linking is this anti-fragile thing. Yes, a lot of links break, but overall the web retains itself. People build workarounds into it. If you build something that tries to protect you from that fragility of the web and of links, and everything is only on one instance, and then what happens one day when that site goes down, you lose a huge chunk of the web in one go. And we've seen that happen over and over again. We've had sites that people build their lives on, they get bought by a big company, and then they get ignored and they die. You know, if you want a nice example of that, Upcoming was this site where you posted events that were happening. It was a community site. It got bought by Yahoo. They ran it for a while. They got fed up and bored, and it died. And
then
2 years
Scott
ago,
Bio. Scott Bio.
Andy Bio.
Andy Bio. Scott Bio is another guy. Andy Bio bought it back and
right,
brought
and
it back.
And he's relaunched it. It's actually up and running now.
What's beautiful is apparently he had the old databases, so he's imported all the old databases, so you can go back and time it, look at events in the past too.
Yeah, that was kind of weird because I made an event on Upcoming for like when Back to the Future happened, and now it's in the past, which
yeah.
is like that's kind of freaky.
Ooh,
no, so the point is that actually what happens when you say, okay, I'm going to build a site that does everything, you're creating fragility debt because it's only one site, and it lasts only as long as you have funding, you have interest, and you don't get bought by somebody who then shuts it down. Whereas if you build something out of protocols, the protocols can last longer than the thing itself. And Mastodon is a good example of that, in that Evan built Identica StatusNet and built the protocol suite, and then decided he was going to do something else, and he's built Pump.io, which is a new protocol and is a probably better design protocol. There's a bunch of standardization work that he's been working on for updating this stuff. But the sort of protocol suite and the code suite that he had has been sitting out there and has implementations running and has just got picked up by somebody else. So we have this thing that is these systems have been running for a while, and suddenly it got popular in the last 2 weeks.
It's kind of fun to have a community. I mean, you wander into a community. It's like a party. And so I think the concern about is this going to last or not last is really misguided. If it's fun now, do it. I've been spending a lot of time over the last week in it because it's fun. It's great. It's a nice group of people.
I mean, you know, there are people who still use NNTP. You know, these protocols don't actually die.
No. How about Manton Reese and micro.blog? Where's the? Because I paid into that, and I guess we're waiting for our invites to that. That's kind of similar idea, right?
Yes. Well, that's built on more of the indie web protocols as well. So that's built on MicroPub and WebMention. Which is the sort of the newer generation of these protocols, and it's also built on WebSub as well to give you the real time part. So there's some overlap between them. And part of what we're trying to do,
that would be almost like having your own blog be your Mastodon site. You microblog there. It goes to your blog. It can be federated. Others can see it. So it's a little more personal. I mean, almost like running your own personal instance that you're the only member of.
Yes, and that's you know, the interesting thing here is this thing of running an instance for a set of other people and giving them a place to converse.
Yeah,
and
like Twit. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can do that with blogs too. This was a thing that you did with blogs. You know, if you remember...
Those didn't scale well, though, because you can't have 1,000 people in a group blog.
No, but these don't scale well. You know, these things fall over at a few thousand too. You know, one of the reasons people set up new instances is because they've hit that... Well, part of this, and I linked an article by Lexi that describes some of these problems, but there's a problem is that MySQL databases aren't designed to deal with networks. And so you get this sort of order n square thing that happens as you try and scale them up that makes it quite hard to do. And you know, Twitter started the same way. Twitter started out with a Rails app that was using a MySQL database, and it worked for a while. And then
we all remember the fail whale. By the way, Mastodon has its own fail Mastodon, I believe.
Yes, it's a parody of the film. It's the master being picked up by birds, of course. But you know, eventually you have to restructure things and build it differently when you're trying to scale to millions of users rather than thousands of users. And so if you want them all to be in one site and want to be fast, you have to do a bunch of massive retooling, and that's quite hard to do. Whereas what this says is we'll build out so it works for a few hundred, a few thousand users, and then we'll federate between them, and we've got some protocols that make that work.
Is the federation pretty efficient? I mean, it can handle a lot more traffic.
There's ways to optimize all of it, but the point of the reason WebSub was invented was to sort of the classic blogging thing was I publish my blog, there's a feed there, and you check my feed every hour and see if I've posted something new. And that works if there's like a few of you doing that. But if I've got 1,000 people who are checking me once an hour, then my site's going to be in pain from that.
Right.
And so what WebSub does is reverse that and say, okay, you registered with the WebSub server. When I post something, I tell the WebSub server, and then it calls all the people who've subscribed to me and says, hey, Kevin's written something new. You take that now. And so rather than you all going to my site and saying, don't anything yet, at the point when I post, it then calls you and says, Kevin's posted something, and then you can update your thing quickly. So that's how you get a response feedback loop.
And you said this was a version of, PubHub.
I love it. It's my favorite name. It's called WebSub now, unfortunately.
It is. Okay.
PubSub was much better.
Okay. This sounds like that, but I can never remember the right order of
it. It uses PubSub HubHub, but it uses some other stuff too.
Okay.
So PubSub was designed to solve that problem. It was written by Brett and Brad probably 10 years ago now, which was the problem was as your blog gets popular, it's hard to keep it up because everyone's polling you all the time to get your feed. And so they said, well, let's reverse this. You don't post that often. When you do post, we'll have a server and it calls the people to do that. And they have to re-register with the server every day to make sure they're still interested. And so there's a protocol for doing that that means you can actually distribute. A, you can get updates in almost real time. And B, you can cope with a lot of people relatively easily compared to them all trying to poll your original blog. So that was the PubSub model. And so that's now called WebSub. We've been taking it through W3C. It's now a candidate recommendation, which is the last thing before becoming an actual official W3C standard. So if you're interested in this stuff, go and look up that and test against it. There's a site called websub.rocks, which lets you test your stuff against it. And Mastodon passes most of the tests, which is a fun part about this. So there's that protocol that's there. The other two protocols that Mastodon uses, I mentioned Webfinger, which is a way of looking at addresses, which is, it works, it's a bit too complicated. And at one point, the big sites implemented it and they backed away from implementing it now, so we have to do something else. The other one it uses is a thing called Salmon, which is a protocol for sending comments upstream so that when I comment on something, you find out about it. Now, this is a protocol that is ridiculously over-engineered because it was designed for you to be able to post comments without actually posting them on your own site. So they had to only exist on the web, which there's this whole back and forth about signing it and basically forming it and wrapping it in XML. So basically the process is very complicated. We have WebMention now, which does the same thing in a much simpler way, but Mastodon and GNU Social are built on this older protocol called Salmon. And at some point we may help them transition to something that's smoother. But that's what works out. And it does work, but it was always quite hard to implement. And if you actually sort of walk through it, it's like that's way more complicated than it needs to be. But you can make it work, which means that's how you get to send the replies back more quickly because you're notifying people that the replies are happening.
It kind of makes sense that you would have a global thing like Twitter that everybody can go to. It's like a news feed. But we also want. I think it's nice to have a local pub you can go to where you hang out with people and you meet new people and you talk and you have a little bit more elaborate conversations. So I don't think it's to replace Twitter, but it's kind of cool. And Gartron is actually using Patreon to raise funds for it, and he's actually I'm happy to say he's got up to like $3,000 a month now on Patreon. Ooh. So he's able to make a living doing this, which is nice.
I mean, he's done a really good job of running an open source project and listening to people and implementing the things that they say.
It's been going on for a long time. I didn't realize, you know, that's it surprised me when you said on Mastodon, oh yeah, I showed you this in November. I went, oh, I must have signed up for an account, and sure enough, I had, and then never used it.
Sure, but he'd been building it for a while before that.
Yeah.
But
you could see this is clearly a fairly mature project. Yeah. You can install it via Docker. The hard thing for the end user is understanding Federation. And the first thing you have to do is figure out which instance you're going to join. And there are all kinds of instances. There are lists of instances. So you can kind of, yes. Some of them have a description.
I was looking at those and I was like, blah.
I think you should join the witches instance.
Witches
town. What are you trying to say, Leah?
Can you do that at certain times of night? They're only open during
They're only open hour. At 8 p.m. British time, I think.
Oh, excellent.
For half an hour. So you have to really jump right in. A lot of closed ones.
Not your time, yes.
Yeah, a lot of closed ones because they're so busy. But there are instances with unique designs, unique flavors. I haven't, you know, I joined a very neutral one by accident because I didn't know what to join.
By accident?
Well, you know, I wasn't immediately obvious. I just don't join when I can get. You know how I joined it? I looked at he had two Xeon servers, and it looked like he had enough horsepower not to go down every 5 seconds.
There you go.
That was it. But it's
your gigahertz.
It's
okay.
Kind of fun. I mean, I don't know how important it is, but it's kind of fun. I'm really looking forward to Manton's microblog. I want to use that because now I have a WordPress blog, and it'll work with my WordPress blog. So I kind of want to use that. I'm interested in that.
So the way to think about this, and I've given you the sort of the big public's hand wave thing before, but the way about this is thinking about what public actually means. And in the literary theory world, they talk about every work that's published has a public, which is the people who read that work. And that's a better way of thinking about it than saying things are either public or private. And there is a public sphere, which just meant there's a very small subset of people who read the newspapers and they're the public sphere and everyone else doesn't count. And what we have now is lots of publics that overlap to different degrees. So we have the public of people who watch Twig, and then we have the public of people who read Jeff's blog, and they intersect to a certain extent, but they're different publics. And the interesting thing about this model is that you're actually constructing layered publics. So you're building a public which is all the people in one instance, and then you're building a slightly bigger public, which is the people who the people in that instance follows. So it's made manifest this kind of sort of soft overlapping publics, which is what we actually the way we use Twitter. With Twitter, we all choose to follow a set of people, and then we also get a feed of the things that they retweet, which is like the next degree out from that. But it doesn't have as hard an edge as this because it's not chosen by instance. It's just it has a softer boundary. So part of what this is doing is making manifest the way that we use the web anyway. So I think that's a very interesting way to think about this. So, obviously we want to be able people to be able to move between instances and this delegate stuff in more than one place. But part of the interesting part that I've got back from people has been, no, I don't want to connect this to Twitter. I like this being a separate thing. I like this being a different public. And because Twitter is now so searchable, that means that people can come and invade your privacy directly by searching for things you're talking about and butting into you. And because Twitter made the replies into this sort of sticky thing that you can't get rid of because every time you reply, everyone you've ever talked to is included in the reply, one of the reasons this has taken off in the last couple of weeks has been reaction to that sort of reply all feature of Twitter. So a big catalyst for this was Sarah Yong writing about this and saying, I'm taking a week off Twitter, I'm going to try something else instead, and going to this and then running a very good article about it that explained a lot of this and brought a lot of people in.
I'm having fun. I'm having fun.
But it strikes me that there's if you look at Twitter as broken, there's two ways to fix it. One way is to go more open, which this did, but give you more control, but yet in the totality of it, less control. The other way is to come up with a controlled Twitter, which I kind of dread, but kind of want at the same time. And I don't know which way to go.
Well, you can have both. Yeah. That's the kind of point. It's not mutually exclusive.
Two or many.
Yeah.
many accounts. Which,
well, you wouldn't want to. You probably wouldn't want to. Well, you might. Okay, you might want to. Like, for instance, I probably would keep an account on a Twit instance, and then maybe a more public account. But that's the point. It's flexible. You could do both. I don't know. It's fun. You should try it.
Yeah,
Jeff,
and
should do it.
Sorry, Stacey, carry on.
No, I was saying, Jeff, we should do it.
What's funny is there's a lot of people with old habits.
You
like
set it up.
People say, like Scobel says, well, I got on and reserved my name. Like you could reserve your name. You can't.
That's so Scobel.
So Scobel. He says, I'll see you in a year if it's still around. So there's a kind of a deep misunderstanding of what this is. It's not Twitter. It really isn't. And it's not a Twitter killer. That's nobody's proposing that.
Except for those dumb journalists. Okay, wait. You guys have 12 minutes before I'm going to leave, and I have not heard you sing happy birthday to me yet.
How quickly you forget. Did we not sing?
No,
oh,
we didn't.
Oh,
we
didn't.
No,
we delegated to robots.
We let the robots do it. All right. After this break, we're going to sing happy birthday. Gargle, get ready, and then we'll do the picks, and then we'll let Stacy go, and we'll let you go, too. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. If you are buying a new home or you're ready to refi, you've got to go to a mortgage lender you can trust who has a transparent operation. And as far as I'm concerned, I want somebody who's going to do it fast and do it online. I don't want to have to go in. And that's what Quicken Loans is doing with Rocket Mortgage, an entirely online mortgage approval process. Everything they need, you can submit with the touch of a button on your phone, on your tablet, on your laptop. You could even do it at an open house. Check statements, pay stubs, whatever. Just press that button. You can even, you know, play with the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get exactly the solution that's right for you. And you'll get approved in minutes. They turn it around in minutes, not days or weeks or, in my case, the last time I bought a house, it took a month. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. Go completely online. Rocket Mortgage. It comes from Quicken Loans. Go to quickenloans.com/twig. quickenloans.com/twig. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org. Number 3030. It's for the geek in us all. The shy folks who don't want to go in and talk to a banker. quickenloans.com/twig. Are you ready, gentlemen?
Wait. Scooter X says it's his birthday too, so we should include him.
Scooter X, one of our chat mods. Okay.
Yeah, so we gotta do two.
So we'll do both.
We want to sing along with Google, or
yeah, maybe because she does a good job.
Oh no.
Oh,
no. This is not Capella, man.
Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3. Happy birthday,
happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to the most amazing, wonderful person in the whole wide world.
Happy birthday to you. How about that?
That was terribly awesome. I hope the Scooter X feels just as loved as I do.
Oh, lordy. All right, let's do some picks and get the heck out of Dodge here. Thank you for explaining Mastodon to me. I knew Kevin would be able to do a good job of that. I appreciate that.
I can keep trying.
Well, I get it now, and I like it. I like it well enough. Stacy, you got a good pick for this. Is, by the way, episode 400. So happy birthday to Twig too. 400 episodes.
Yeah. Wow. I'm feeling very old.
Why don't you
kick the audience? How many hours have you wasted with us, audience? How many hours?
Don't get them thinking about that.
Wasted.
It's not wasted.
You're with friends.
If this were a full-time job and you're getting paid $10 an hour, you'd have $8,000 now. How about that? That's pretty good. I owe you some money, I think. Stacy, your pick of the week.
Send you an invoice.
Okay.
Send me an invoice.
So my pick of the week is to address everybody out there who's asking me about light switches that are Wi-Fi and dimmable. So this is hard.
Lutron one or the whatever that you told me to get?
Lutron is not Wi-Fi. You have to buy the hub to get it on your Wi-Fi. So this is a standalone for $50. Let me put it the right way. Ta-da! This is the Leviton Decora 5 Wi-Fi switch. There it is. It's $50 on Amazon. And it's a switch. You have to install it. You do have to install the Leviton app on your phone. But from there, you can link it to your Echo account. And then you can use voice to turn this on or off.
Wow.
So
That including Amazon Echo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
It doesn't come with an Amazon Echo.
No. Echo sold separately.
And it also has, I should say, a double faceplate. So it's white or almond comes in the box, if you have a preference. It sets back to a neutral, which is good because if you are, it won't, if you have like connected bulbs, it's not going to break your bulbs when you turn it on and off. So that's good. The dimmer function doesn't go all the way down to dim. It doesn't go, it doesn't go to off. So you have to hit the button, but that's kind of a downside. And it also has these words on it, which I'm kind of like, guys, we don't have to brand everything.
Oh man, that's on the faceplate, the visible faceplate?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer.
That it is a bummer. So that is my pick for y'all.
Thank you. And yes. You're going to have a wonderful, what's your favorite sushi? You're going to sushi tonight.
Okay. I like the sea urchin sushi,
that's good.
Only when it's fresh. No. So the uni.
Is that uni? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's baby diaper.
No, yeah. That's good.
Can't do it.
It's delicious.
I like it. I like the ebi, the yama ebi.
I like sushi, but that's the one I can't do.
I like
do.
The spicy tuna. I know that's a tourist sushi.
Yeah.
I like the spider roll with the soft shell crab. I like that too. Now
tourist
I'm hungry.
Sushi.
Yeah.
Now I'm hungry.
I eat tourist sushi. I don't eat sushi with big hunks of raw meat on it. Raw fish on it.
Oh, I do. I love it.
I do, yeah. No, that's my sushi tip is read the things on the rolls and order the one that is mostly fish and doesn't have crab or tempura
cream
shrimp.
Cheese.
Or
no cream cheese. Cream is sacrilege.
I don't know why they put cream cheese. That's disgusting. Philadelphia roll, disgusting.
Yeah, but basically there's one side of the menu that is like crispy random crap. And then there's another piece of the menu that is we put these bits of fish together because they taste good together. And you order from that piece, and that's when you get the good sushi.
Right.
I usually do omakase if I can. So.
Oh, you're a pro.
Which is great.
Oh,
yeah. Are you doing that tonight?
That's the plan. Yeah. My daughter, who's 10, she's like, can I bring a book? Because it's going to be one of those long, fancy dinners, isn't it?
Omakase is when the chef picks it.
The great Calvin Trillin wrote in the New Yorker about taking his kids along on these food tours, and he would say that his daughter would always bring in an in-case bagel.
See, this is my kids grew up in California, so you know, for them, tuna was this red thing that you eat in sushi places.
Right? They didn't understand tuna fish.
I gave them canned tuna, and they were like, "What is this gray nonsense? This is not awful. Tuna.
What is this cat food?
It's cat food."
Yeah, it's like. This Kevin, tuna.
Kevin, your pick of the week. Your stuff this week.
I've given you some bunch of stuff already. Let's see.
Yeah, we did upcoming.org, and Andy Bios brought it back. It's wonderful. Thrilled.
Yes, if you want to organize events, go there, do it, try it out. It's great. It's independent. It's not going away again. He's not going to sell it again. It's just nice. Another nice community of people building things for each other. Websub I mentioned. There are some indie web camps coming up, indieweb.org. There's...
I just booted Windows 3.
I was going to save that one for last. Okay.
Okay, go ahead. No, go ahead. I was just getting it started up. Wait a minute. Close the window. Go on, Kevin.
Sorry. So indiewebcamp.org, we have... there's a bunch of indie web camps coming up in Europe in the next month. And there's the Indie Web Summit in Portland, June 24th, 25th, which is like the big everyone comes together one. A lot of the Indie Web work connects to these other protocols I've been talking about. And it connects to Manton's project as well. I think he's hoping to bring some of that to this summit.
This is so important. And it's just you're doing really important work to make the web accessible and open to all and to have it all work together. I'm really glad you're doing this. And indieweb.org is the website.
And a lot of this is trying to build these kind of protocols that people can then build on and surprise us with interesting things like Mastodon and so on.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And one of the things we got going this week was making sure that Mastodon has the microformat stuff on so it will interoperate with the Indie Web when you post the link to it. So
good.
I was saying this about Eugene being very good at listening to the community and taking pull requests and following these bugs. And he has been extremely good about that.
Good.
That is the reason this thing has succeeded has been that he's been listening to people and saying, oh, yeah, that would work. Oh, we should do that. We should do that too.
Yeah, I think better than Keybase, a rel.me would be fantastic. That would really be nice.
That would be good.
Yeah.
I'm going to encourage that one to happen too. But then the fun one, and this came from Andy Bauer as well, is Windows 3.1 in web VR. So go on.
I'm gonna do it now. I did it because I thought, well, this will take a while to load as Windows 3 is wont to do. Here we go. Windows for Workgroups 3.1.1 in VR. Well, look, Trumpet Windsock is loading. So now I can actually use this?
Yes.
And what does it mean that it's in web VR? Can I...
You can turn your head if you do it on the phone.
Oh, my God. You can look around.
Holy cow.
This is a lot of work. Somebody put a lot of work into this. What did I dial into? CompuServe? Genie?
Prodigy?
Oh, my. It runs even on a phone. Oh, I see. So as you move the phone around, I get it.
You turn it around, then you get the back of it.
I can't see it. Right. You get the back of it? Oh, nice. And it's just as slow as Windows 3.1.1 was. So show your kids. This is what it used to be.
And now you're running Pac-Man.
I'm running Pac-Man, which I deeply regret. What is it? Function Alt F4? I can't even remember. Yep. Nope. That closed the browser. Oh, well, never mind. Thank you, Kevin Marks. Always a pleasure. And I'm sorry we lost you to Yorkshire.
Oh, yeah, I'm not lost. So there was an article in The Guardian that I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who wrote it, David Goodhart. And he said there's a different way of thinking about politics. He says there are somewhere people and anywhere people. And the anywhere people don't really care where they are because they're connected to the world and they can relocate around the world and get stuff working. And I've kind of been that. But then there are the somewhere people who say, no, I'm in this place. This place makes sense to be. I want to live here. I want to continue in this place. And coming back to Yorkshire has been an exercise having a somewhere again.
That's where you're from originally.
Well, it's where Rosie's from. I mean, for me, it's, you know, for me, it's the UK as a whole. But it's definitely being connected back to family and being in a place again.
I'm a somewhere person who wants to be an anywhere person. You're an anywhere person who's now somewhere.
That's about right. Yeah.
That's nice, Kevin. I'm glad to hear it. Jeff, your number of the week.
So I'll make this quick because Stacey has a wreck her sushi waiting, and you don't want stale sushi.
The omakase awaits.
No, you don't want that. So Ezra Klein put up a piece on Vox today about a study done by Levi Boxell, Matthew Grenzkow, and Jesse Shapiro that found that, yes, American politics are broken. Yes, we're more polarized, but they found that polarization is greater among those who use the internet least. Which is primarily to say older people. What media do older people use?
Fox
Cable
News.
TV and Fox talk News. Radio.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's my own dear parents.
Yeah.
So not to say that there isn't also polarization among the young, not to say that social media doesn't have a role there.
But the however, internet, I think that's astute. I think that's accurate.
Yeah, it is, I think. And social media always gets the blame, and you know, full disclosure here is I just our university just took some money from Facebook, so I'm not doing this.
No, but
as a
at least we're
Facebook.
In a conversation.
Yes, exactly. And you have a sense that there's another side, and you have a sense that it's there, and you have to argue with it. Whereas on Fox News and on talk radio, all you get is the one-sided propaganda view. It's really interesting research, and that's my numbers.
As somebody who works for years in talk radio, I would agree.
Of course,
with you.
The real number of the week is 39.
39. It's a good number. God, I'd give anything to be 39 again.
I was like, what? Why is that the number of the week?
Oh, give me a break.
A little tribute to Stacey.
I'm like, nowhere. What?
I guess I should save this because we're running out of time. But Google announced a very interesting a new website. We played with it a little bit yesterday called AutoDraw. Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah.
I love this.
So was this built on the thing they built before that was like the Pictionary game? Was that training this?
Oh, I don't. They don't really say exactly where it came from. It's an AI experiment. It uses the same. If you're learning more about magic behind AutoDraw, check out QuickDraw, one of our AI experiments. It's AutoDraw's suggestion tool uses the same technology as QuickDraw.
Yeah, that was the one. Yeah.
Okay, so
that
it is.
So it to that, yeah.
Watch what's happened. So, and by the way, it's terrible at stick figures. So, stick figures are the wrong thing. But if I draw a car, Okay, it's not a very good car, I understand. But you know what? AutoDraw knows it's a car and says, do you mean that kind of car or that kind of car? Or maybe you mean a Volkswagen van? I know it had wheels, so was it a skateboard? This is so much fun. Should we start over, do another one? How about I do a very poor happy face? I could do better. I have a pen. And then it says, oh, you meant, yeah, that's exactly what I meant. Or that.
What if you try to draw like a group of buildings? Like something
sure.
It's not just a single object?
Sure. Let's see.
What happens?
And look what I get. Look at that.
Oh, nice.
It's so super smart. Or grass.
Or grass, yeah.
Or grass.
That was the other option.
Or high heel shoes. I mean, it gives you a broad variety of things. And by the way, you can then use it. You could use this with your daughter to make greeting cards and stuff, right? So you can.
Yes.
Yes. It's fun.
We do a lot of greeting cards.
I bet you do. Do you?
No. We did our first craft. We did our annual craft with string eggs, which was really complicated.
For some reason, my kids, there was a lot of potato prints. I don't know. You know what we should do? And we're going to show you this on Saturday. We finally got our pancake printer working. What is that supposed to be? Batman? Transformers. Well, let me see the other one.
Oh, it's Optimus Primus.
Optimus Primus. Primus. And this is a fish?
It's you. What?
That's me? Really? That's me?
We have some research to do.
You got to work on it. It does make excellent pancakes, though. We're going to show that on Saturday, the new pancake printer. We got it. We got ours. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, happy birthday to Stacy and Scooter X. Happy birthday to everybody celebrating today. Thank you, Kevin Marks. Now in Yorkshire, IndieWeb.org, at Kevin Marks
on
Twitter.
Big couch.
And everywhere. And I love that couch. That couch is awesome. That couch has a...
No poodles this time. The poodles are upstairs.
It has a story to tell, that couch. Thank you, Kevin. Great to have you on. I appreciate it. Thanks to Jeff Jarvis, CUNY, City University of New York. BuzzMachine.com is his blog. He writes at Medium and also has some great books, including What
We
Do.
And I'm wearing my
Public Parts.
ProPublica t-shirt.
It's not... We're not shutting up. ProPublica. ProPublica.com. Is it .org? ProPublica. Go to ProPublica. Awesome
go to
site.
ProPublica. Just ask Google and you'll get there.
Nonprofit public interest reportage.
Won a Pulitzer.
Stacey Higginbotham. She deserves many Pulitzers. She covers IoT at StaceyOnIoT.com and the IoTPodcast.com. And she's at GigaStacy on the Twitter and joins us every Wednesday for This Week in Google. Thank you, Stacey. Have a great time at dinner. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Please tune in. Join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. Maybe someday you'll be able to toot on our Mastodon instance. I don't know. I'll let you know when that happens. After the fact, just go to twit.tv/twig or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, and you're sure to get an episode or two. Maybe you can get one every week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This is me? Really? On This Week in Google. It's just like me, right?